You know by now that we're Melanetta Shetler, and we've pastored for 45 years, something like that. Mm-hmm. We're still half-time on the staff at Maple City. We were lead pastor for 43 years there. And we were really young when the church called us, and a lot of stuff that we did, it feels like it happened backwards. Like, I planned to be a businessman, and before then I were married through circumstances at work. All at once I was put in management position of over 400 people in this plant, charge of hiring and firing and placing people in jobs and things like that. So it was a really, and I was a production manager, so I really, my whole personality was bent that things could be done faster and better and with better quality and things like that. And I would have, I brought that into our marriage early on, and our, and guess how that worked. When we attended Rosedale here back then, we used to have duty of washing dishes. They didn't have all the stuff they did now. So you pulled duty, but after a while, everybody wanted to be in my dishwashing crew because we had cut down 15 minutes on the dishwashing. Yeah. I thought things in our home could be done faster and better organized and things like that. And I look at back then, you know, when we kind of talked to our kids about this assignment and a little and thought, well, what were you going to say? We want to both have you learn from our mistakes and things that we felt like we really learned.
But, and you'll find out that, maybe you'll find out, but he might have one view about this subject. I probably have another one. The kids probably would tell you something different. So you're going to hear a lot of different views.
And I really, Freedon, just to interrupt here and talk as she feels she has something to share here too. And then we want to leave you with what we believe, five principles that we feel are pretty important for you when it comes to how you take care of yourself and your family. So Edna's kind of going to introduce our family a little bit.
So, yeah, tell you a little bit about us. We have six children. Their ages would be 50 to 37 now. So we had to think back really far to put ourselves in your age. We'd been about your age when Mel was ordained. And then we have 16 grandchildren. They're ages 26 to 3. We do some babysitting yet. This is fun. And they all live like within 10 minutes within our place, except one. That's 15 minutes. And they all come in our church are involved there. And so we feel blessed, but I would also add, wherever God wants them, we would feel blessed. So we have a picture of our family. I don't know if you have that available. Is it up there?
Well, that's kind of back then.
This is 44 years ago. Now, they're all ours. This one's ours, too. But our oldest daughter is married to the black-haired one. So that was, 30 years ago. We would have been about 44 years old. Hmm. Now you can figure out how old we are.
How many did we have in diapers at one time?
Well, I was going to tell that later, but...
Okay.
Just hold on. I'll tell that later.
Okay.
Something about our family is that we fought loud and we made up loud. We were willing to, people were willing, you know, kids could say how they felt. We were straight shooters. I was a straight shooter. Mm-hmm. So, we, But in that, I would say, it is really important, whether you fight loud or quiet or not at all, that there's respect. I think that's really missing today in families, husbands and wives to each other, and the children to parents and so on. But learning to respect and speak respectfully, I think it's really important.
I think we actually, earlier Edna and I talked about this, that we would hear some couples pridefully say, our children never ever heard us fight. And we often felt like we didn't want that principle, that we wanted our children to learn how to resolve a conflict and see it done in front of them in a respectful way. And so Ed and I sometimes would have our conflict right at the evening table. Okay, let's stop and talk through this a little bit.
Sorry. Will you forgive me? And the kids hated it when we made them give each other a hug and say they're sorry. They talk about that nowadays yet. But it was good.
Yeah.
And they would say it's good.
And besides having six children, a lot of our married life, we had people living with us. Early on, we had mattresses leaning against the wall somewhere and kids off the street that needed a home. And there's a guy in our church that back 45 years ago, one night him and his wife got in a fight and he was using a steel chair to beat her, and I restrained him, wrestling down and restrained him, and he held that grudge against me until about 2 weeks ago. And he's got cancer now and he's close to dying. So he all at once is forgiving me for that. He's held that grudge for that long. And two Sundays ago I preached, and he actually sat there through a sermon. When he got out, he said, hey, Mel, good job.
Say a little bit about how our church started.
For some of you that you're well aware of this, but our church, the background of our church, when I said a lot of our stuff, it seemed like we did it backwards. I was managing this mobile home plant and had a renewal experience with God. And I recall the morning, one of the journals I was reading was John Wesley's journal, and he had a little slogan about taking the gospel to the marketplace. And that just really, here I am managing this place where guys cuss and swear and sweat. And if the gospel should really make a difference, it should be in this place. So I took my Bible to work and put it on the left corner of my desk. And to me, that meant that as of today, I'm going to try to, in a winsome way, bring the gospel to the marketplace. And it wasn't long until I was going home with guys from work whose marriage was on the rocks, or kids were rebellious, or anyways. And then these guys started going to church with me. And the same time, Ed and I started working with some gangs that we had in our community, and they started going to church with us. And so my pastor came one day, and he actually was teared up, and he said, this is not how it should be, but this is not going to work. He said, I'd really, if this is what God's calling you to, you just need to go start your own church. And so we didn't want to take that right away, so we started to go to some other churches, but we did wear out our welcome wherever we went. And so I remember the first service, we had 36 people there. Dory, she thought I was speaking too long, and she lit up a cigarette. She was sitting right up here in the front. She lit up a cigarette and mumbled about it was taking me too long. The third Sunday, the Clark boys and the McDonald's, and the Clark is one that talked to me 2 weeks ago, they got in a fight the third Sunday. They did not think they could be in the same church together. And so they got in a fight right in the service. So we didn't start out very good. It didn't go very well. But that's the background today of Maple City Chapel.
And the setting was a building in town that used to be Salvation Army. We lived upstairs, and our fourth child was born while we lived up there. And we had a couple girls that would stay with us and live up there, and the boys stayed in the basement. And I you know, I'm just giving you that picture, that setting, and we've got these four kids that are 1 and 2 and 5 and 6. And I look back and I read some of those newsletters and I think, what in the world were we doing? I mean, we didn't know what we were doing, but just looking back and seeing God's faithfulness to us, keeping us safe. And
when our daughter was in kindergarten, the kindergarten teacher told Edna and I that she liked to talk with us, that she thinks our daughter has a problem telling lies, and they're kind of extraordinary lies. So we were really interested in what this is about. So we went in and asked what it was, and she said, well, something about some guy had held a knife to her dad's throat or something. And we said, yeah, that's true. And then, so what else? And she said, well, guy was cutting himself and his sheets were all bloody. And he said, yeah, that's true. And I think it was a third story. And finally, the kindergarten teacher on her, she looked at me and she said, your daughter should be playing with dolls, not in that kind of a setting. And so it scared us a lot. We didn't know what this was going to do to our kids. But through it, God protected them. We had three buildings that we were working with. So we had a board of directors, and I felt pressure from them to go out and raise money. So here's some wrong things that we did. 1 year I was gone over half the year, gone from home, out raising funds. And so the first principle I'd like to talk about is, I remember one time we were going to the airport, and the two oldest kids were just little, sitting in the back seat, and one of them started whining about dad leaving again or something. And Edna turned around in the front seat and she said to them something about, aren't you glad that you have a father who cares about sharing the gospel? I forget just how she were. Anyways, when she got done, they both were like sitting up tall, like proud of their dad. And I thought that even though, now looking back, that in my mind was not a wise thing for me to do. But what we learned through that is that Edna's attitude, I think, had more to do with it than the wrong I was doing. You know, it saved the day. And so the principle I'm talking about here is that spouses' attitudes really do matter. And Edna and I have worked hard at that over the years. There's times like even today where I may say to her sometimes, honey, right now I just feel emotional distance from you. I don't know why. I can't think of anything you've done, but can we talk about it a little bit? And it's the importance of trying to get back on the same page so that we can have a good attitude, a good spirit about... I remember hearing a preacher one time on the way to church. He had just scolded his kids all morning because they weren't getting ready for church. And then his daughter, when they drove in the yard, she said, hey, Dad, it's time for you to get your preacher's face on. It's like when they pulled in the churchyard. Mm-hmm. So that kind of a spirit. Did you want to say something about that one?
I want to talk a little about giving up expectations. So maybe this is where this fits in. I think I had expectations from Mel to meet all my needs, just unconsciously. This is just, you know, he was there to meet my needs. And I think with the children that we had, the amount of kids we had, and I'm going to give you the ages here, so you can picture with me, with Mel being going quite a bit. And so our fifth child, so it was a new baby and a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old, an 8-year-old and a 9-year-old. And we were pastoring and had this Teen Haven thing. And it was, how do you take care of a new baby and a 2-year-old and a 3-year-old? An 8-, 9-year-old help. But, you know, I had to just give up expectations. Mel was traveling. Some the expectations that, maybe even a few expectations that I shouldn't have, but that was important to do sometimes too. But just letting people help, other people help, keep the baby during church, or I remember how I would go to conference with all six of them, or, you know, six then, and thinking, why am I here? Or to a pastor's retreat, why did I come? You know, I wasn't getting anything out of the, and I was running around trying to keep everybody happy, and they went to class, which was good. But, you know, I resolved that by just giving up expectations. I'm not coming to hear the speakers. I'm not, you know, it's great if I do then, but I'm here. I get the fellowship. I get to know the people, and the kids get in with the classes, and it made a world of difference, giving up some expectations. So I would just say that whatever stage you're in, season you're in, look at your expectations, and maybe giving up a few of them and might be helpful to release stress.
So with that, and this forming this principle that I think it's a false expectation to believe that your spouse should meet all your needs. I remember the day when Edna released me from that. In Edna's background, she had a dad that died when she was five. She had a brother that was killed in a car accident. She had another brother that died in an accident at work, a carpenter accident, got into ready-mix spout in the truck stalled a few times, so he stepped in the gas and crushed him in a building. So she, early on, had this feeling everybody I loved, God took away from me. So here now, she's married to me, and her husband goes off. And her fear every time I leave at that time was, are you going to come back? Because everything God took away from me that I loved. And
there's times I'd sit there and cry and plan his funeral. I mean, it was a genuine fear.
And to tell you, the healing that happened during that time was that today, she's glad to see me go. I get a break from this, you know, and that's the healing that happened. But I know the time when she looked me in the eye and she said, honey, in her walk with God, she said, I've been holding you to meet all my needs, and I'm releasing you from that. And that was a big day in our ministry. It didn't excuse my behavior, which we'll talk about a little bit.
The other thing I think I want to mention is that allowing people to put expectations on you, especially your church, you know, don't let the church make your rules for your home. There's so many needs, you can't meet them all, but you do need to be there for each other and your family. And sometimes I think as pastors, we put expectations on our kids. I remember one time somebody came to talk to us about some behavior one of our kids had done in Sunday school. And it was, you know, it was just I don't remember what it was, but it was a childish thing. It wasn't a thing of rebellion, or it was just like, but because you're a preacher's kid, they ought not be doing this. So I didn't receive that. I mean, I receive, you know, I hear it, but I think it's kind of like when Mel and I, one time, some Sunday morning, Mel said something about some fight we had that morning before we came to church, and I don't remember what your point was, but he mentioned that, and somebody came and said, man, if you guys aren't going to make it, you think we can? I said, what? Oh, we're going to make it. It's not that our marriage is on the rocks, but just back in that day, you didn't talk about like you do nowadays. You weren't open about your fights or your differences and stuff, and you didn't go for counseling. I mean, you were really on the rock if you went for counseling. It was looked down on. So those kind of things, sometimes pastors and wives, we can put ourselves up on the pedestal. Is that people put us on the pedestal because we put ourselves there. So I think vulnerability and is important.
The third principle, and I could word it different, but then you probably wouldn't remember it as easy, but us and our children use this sometimes. Be where your butt is. I remember one time I was in my study and some women from church showed up and they didn't know I was in my study. And they were out and I heard them telling Edna, they were like lamenting with her that her husband is ministering, he's gone so much, and then when he is home there are people who want to talk to him and so on. And so I'm all ears what Edna's going to answer them because I didn't hear this conversation. So after they quit a little bit and gave Edna a little time, she said, I want you to know something about Mel. She said, when he's home, he's home. And then I asked her later what she meant by that. But we know some farmers in our church that are home all the time, but are hardly ever home. They're not where they really are. They're off into something, or they're, you know. And today more than ever, I mean, we've some of our children, they have times where no screen time, and you just gotta. So you're totally present where you are, and so I think that's a big factor when you get in leadership and you're a pastor, is to be fully present with where you are, and be engaged. And you were saying about that? Okay. The fourth one, I was in right during this time when things were pretty chaotic. I was constantly juggling, like, you know, the church would be going pretty good. Then Edna would, I remember one day I needed to go to Mishawaka, 45 minutes away, and ask if she'd like to go along. She said, yeah, she'd like that. So on the way over, the sun was kind of shining in her window there, and she got a little sleepy, and she kind of laid over on me and slept on the way over and had a nap, and that was just great. And the way home, we had small talk about this and that. And got up the next morning, and she said, honey, I really have got to have some time with you. And I'm thinking, yesterday, 45 minutes over, 45 minutes back, and now she's saying, I really got to have some time with you. So I tried to find a nice way to say that. And then this is what she said to me. She said, honey, she said, I thought about that. She said, you know, people do take a lot of your time. And I looked a couple times in your eyes and in your heart to see whether I had an invitation. And I didn't think I got it. And I thought about how sensitive she was about that. And so it really made me be aware of what may all be going on inside of her. So right at that time, I'm in this meeting, and things at the church would be go good, and then my wife would give me signals that home isn't going good, and home was going good, and then the elders, some things neglect in church. Being drugged back and forth in this. So I go to this meeting, and the speaker challenged us to go home and outserve our wives. I thought, you know, I'm going to try and do that. And Edna especially has kind of a gift and a knack for serving. So I go home, and I start making the bed, and we got four bathrooms, and I started cleaning the bathrooms. And Still cleaning bathrooms. And I started to get recipe books, and at bedtime I started reading recipes, and I started making meals, and I started sweeping the floors, and I don't know what all. But anyways, the more I started trying to outserve her, the more I found my love for her increase. I think there's something in guys sometimes with that a little bit. But I got to appreciate her a lot more and love her a lot more, And so I feel like in my lifetime that I've met, this sounds awful, but I feel like I met a lot of lazy pastors. And this may be my production management background coming, but sometimes they can, you know, you can, it's harder today with cell phones to get lost, but pastors usually could get lost between office and home and not managing time very well and things like that. So I felt like there's a lot more I could do to serve in our home along with what I was doing in the office. Well, the last fifth principle. Summarize, just to in our relationship and taking care of each other was, I wanted to brush up on my serving because I termed it for me, I was going to try to outserve my wife. The fifth one, I was in a meeting one morning where this guy talked about this verse in 1 Peter 3:7. It talks about honoring your wife as the weaker vessel, and then there's this phrase in the end, so that your prayers not be hindered. And for some reason that morning, that last phrase scared me more than ever in my life. Wonder what it meant. And thought maybe that's the reason none of my prayers are being answered. At least not as many as I thought should be, or whatever. But I always, from the start of our marriage, Edna always had an interest in prayer. She had a heart for prayer. I remember when we were dating, when I asked her, I told my mom one day that I'm growing to love this girl, and talked to her. That time we did things like, it was called like going steady. So I talked to my mom a little about it, and she thought it was probably a good idea. So I asked Edna if she'd go steady with me. And in our terms back then, it meant that now we're going to kind of quit looking around. We're going to focus more on each other and try to take our relationship a step further and so on. So the night I asked her, she had this, it felt kind of like a strange request. She said, that she would love to do that. She said she has one request. And I said, what's that? And she said, I'm not saying you have to do it every time, but if you would consistently, at least sometime with before you leave, if you'd pray with me. I thought, man, I can do that. That'll be all right. You know, that goes with it. I can do that. But I discovered at that point that I don't think it's just me, because I've talked with a lot of other guys that if I was struggling a little battleground with my thoughts with Edna and keeping my hands where I should keep them, so it was really hard to pray with her, you know. And so. Taking that then into marriage, if I felt like my attitude or something wasn't right with Edna, I just found it wasn't the easiest thing to do. And sometimes I'd rather run out the back door than pray with her. And especially after I'd hear her pray, I didn't think I prayed very, very good. And some of it might have been my Amish background, where you didn't pray out loud a lot, and my dad, when he did pray, it was a memorized prayer. I remember the first day I heard my dad lead a spontaneous prayer at our breakfast table, he teared up before he got done, and wow, that's different. And today, Edna's a candle person. I learned to like candles. We like to light a candle, and today I really look forward to our prayer times. I really do. I really enjoy that with Edna. But I'm just telling you, I struggled with that. There was a time when I struggled with that, and I totally didn't understand it. Felt inadequate. So one of the biggest things I felt in taking care of myself, my family, was to really I began to pray. I began to journal in prayer. One of the top prayer people back in that day was a guy by the name of Dick Eastman. I think he's still living. Wrote a book, Change the Hour That Changed the World, I think is the book. I had Dick Eastman come to our church, and I'll never forget one night he was preaching, and he said, "Do you want to know why my words have power?" And I'm sitting there saying, "Yes, that's why we invited you here." And he said that for however many years, I think it was close to 40-some years by then, he said, "I have not failed to spend 1 hour in prayer every day." And after he left, I admit, I just started legalistically the first morning. I determined from now on I'm going to spend an hour in prayer. So I started in. I had prayed for Ed and our kids and my family, and I had the church list of all. I prayed down over all the names, and I think I looked at my watch, and it was about 20-25 minutes, and I now what am I going to do? And that's how I begin my prayer time. But we just moved recently, and I come across these old journals from way back then of starting to journal my prayer time. And I'm just saying, it's to me, it's really key for care of yourself and your families to pray together. I started meeting with some guys at church Friday, Thursday. There were two groups, Thursday and one Saturday morning. They'd come to our house, and we'd go do some sport exercise and so on, but then we were memorizing the book of Philippians, and we all had journals. And it was during that time that Jay was my oldest son at that time. He came to me and said, "Dad," he said, "you know what you're doing with these guys at church?" And he said, "Yeah." And he said, "I'd like to do that with you." And a while back he was preaching, and to my surprise he had his journal from back then and told the church what that journal meant to him, and in a prayer journal that we did together. So, you want to say something about that, Edna?
I just want to add, personally, how did I take care of myself? To you wives, one of the things he's talking about, journaling, that was something important that I did. I didn't do it every day. Might have not done it every week. But like he said, I have lots of journals that aren't organized. But to go back and look over them, and especially I would journal during the hard times and just cry out to the Lord. Or then I would be in the Word and praying. I mean, it was in claiming promises. And I wanted to share one of those in Isaiah. I liked Isaiah also. And one of those was in Isaiah 50 mornings, I would often just claim this promise. "The sovereign Lord has given me his words of wisdom so that I may know how to comfort these weary ones." And it felt like we were all pretty weary sometimes. And the kids. "And morning by morning, he wakens me and opens my understanding to his will. The sovereign Lord has spoken to me, and I have listened. I will not rebel or turn away." And it was just a promise of hope and commitment, and that the Lord's going to be with me during that day, each day. I mean, we were in the era where lots of gardening, and we even had a cow at one time that I had to milk when he was gone. His chickens, and there was I would do the sewing for the kids. I'm not sure why, because it wasn't that we didn't believe in buying clothes, but I remember one day I had material stretched out over the floor and was going to cut out some clothes for the girls, and I had a friend stop by, and she said, "What are you doing?" She said, "Here's some money, go buy some clothes." And it was just, I think, being in the Word, praying, and taking time to pray, and writing it down. It's so wonderful to go back and see the promises that were written down when we were in that time. I want to share one other one. This was especially when the kids, you know, when they got to be teenagers, and probably some of the hardest times in our lives was when we went through some church conflict with the leadership that we went through, and our oldest daughter was in high school and she got pregnant and had a child out of wedlock, and it was, and we were preachers. And Mel and I were not on the same page at that time, of just kind of wanted to just blame each other with it. And the church was awesome during that time, but there was a lot of difficulty. You know, I'm going to cry about it yet. But anyhow, this is one of the verses in Isaiah that I kept clinging to, was the Lord will comfort Israel again, will comfort us, and have pity on her ruins. Her desert will blossom like Eden, her barren wilderness like the garden of the Lord. Joy and gladness will be found there. Songs of thanksgiving will fill the air. And just to hang on to that promise in those dark times and difficult times, of that, hey, the Lord's going to bring good out of this, and there's going to be gladness. And so there's a lot of things we wish we would have done different, but just because a couple other things I'd like to say along with that is that as the children got older, we're into sports and stuff, and I said today it's even more difficult, I think, to be together. There's families, they don't barely have a meal together during the day because everybody's going one way or the other. And we made a practice of having breakfast together and have some devotional time often with that. But just to be together that time meant a lot. So you want to say something? I want to say something about that. I want to say something about family trips. And the other thing is that family trips, we didn't plan trips to Disney or hardly plan trips to anywhere except to go with Mel when he was invited out to the churches to preach. And so we would go a day extra or something and stop somewhere and make it a day. But we did take one trip as a family. There were six children, and Reggie would have been about three, I think. And we all got in a van with a tent and went out west for a month. And that was a highlight that they all remember. Good.
I think with the fifth or final point you were talking about, I'm talking about kind of the disciplines. I used to always say to myself, Mel, you need to manage yourself so you can lead others. And managing myself was to be consistent in prayer and journaling. The other thing that I really worked, I love to read. I had a first grade teacher, Alice Aish. When I look back, we had two first grade rooms, and I always envied the other first grade teacher because she let the first graders use popsicle sticks so they wouldn't lose their place and they could use these popsicle sticks to read. Alice Aish never let us use popsicle sticks. She would make little holes in a paper, and she wanted to see our eyes jump, not just go steadily across the page. She wanted us to learn to see a quarter of a page at a time. And today when I look back at Alice Aish and her teaching, Edna hands me a book, I can slowly page that book. And I tell her exactly what's on that page. I can read it.
I challenge him sometimes with it. You don't know what you read there. I'm going to ask him some questions. And I can read it slow. And he asked me the questions. I don't remember them, but he can answer them.
So I devoured books over the years. And we live about 2 hours from Grand Rapids, Michigan, which in my mind is a publishing capital of the world. And when I first attended Rosedale, I learned authors from men that were my heroes. And I would take these authors and go up to Grand Rapids, and we would come home with trunk load of books. And go back, another trunk load of books. I got theology books. I got books on counseling. I got any book I could find. And just, you know, grew up Amish. We quit at the 10th grade. Like I said, did a lot of things backwards. I went to seminary. They said, well, they didn't know what to do with me because I didn't finish high school. They couldn't put me in a Master Divinity program. So they gave me a CTH, a Certificate of Theology, which meant I was in the same, did the same work Richard Showalter did. We went together. I got a CTH and he got a Master Divinity. I went out to Fuller Theological Seminary. They didn't know what to do with me out there. But because the Anabaptist Seminary took me, they took me. And so, again, I don't like to hear anybody make an excuse for not being able to keep growing and learning. And so I really challenge you, young minister, read. And the only difference sometimes when you do all that by yourself, you can become dogmatic in something. So I would like to really discuss and, you know, some of my best times today, like there's 8 pastors at Maple City, and except for one, the rest of them are all young guys like you. And one of my biggest joys is discussing, batting stuff around with them. They're big followers of Andy Stanley and these guys, and I like to read them too, but then I'll ask them questions about it, you know. And I think Andy Stanley words things sometimes in a way just to get people. I mean, he could word it different and not cause near the controversy he does. But anyways, I think that's about it. We're going to just stop and ask if Ed and I are open to talk about anything. So we're just going to pause a little bit. If there's something you want to...
Any questions you have?
Yeah, any questions you have.
We might have an answer, we might not. Did it get easier as the kids got older? No. Because when they were younger, you could just kiss those tears away. And as they got older, they might have taken care of themselves. But it took time to talk things through. You had to take time, when they were teenagers, to talk things through and take them places. I don't know. But each stage has their highlights as their fun and their good points, but I wouldn't say it was easier.
Each time had times of special joy for me, like even like when my kids were in high school or they were in college and they'd come home and talk about stuff that I remember our daughter came home, she had gone to Taylor, which was kind of overtly Christian, and then switched back to Goshen for her final year, and she came home one day, and her Bible professor had said that Mary wasn't necessarily a virgin, that the name didn't mean she was a virgin. So I said, ask him tomorrow if that the name for her that's used there for her as a maiden is it ever not a virgin? So next day class, she asked. She just said, I'm just curious. Yesterday, when you said that the word for Mary as a maiden is not necessarily mean virgin, was it ever not a virgin? And he looked at her and he said, I could see you did your homework. That's all he said, you know. And so, but those were the kinds of challenges I really liked with my kids at the various stages to remember. Reggie one day said, Dad, they're going to in health class talk about sex. And he said, they said your parents could come. He said, would you like to come? And so I said, yeah, I'll come. So I'm sitting there and we're watching this movie for these, fifth grade or whatever it was. So we get all done watching this. And I turned to him. I said, well, Reggie, I said, what do you think about this? He said, Dad, he said, I really don't think I need to worry about that. He said, Mom said Jesus is coming back.
Before he gets married. So, I had that. Didn't have that right. I better not predict.
So you all have those times too where your children can just say the funniest things, as serious as they can be. Oh. But
it just
this is not necessarily because you're a pastor or a pastor's wife, but write down the funny things your kids say. Just, you know, keep track of those things that no matter, in different stages, they just say different things. And it's just, yeah, even now with grandkids, it's just fun in life.
I even have some things of the church kids. I remember at church one day, I'm passing the guy's restroom. This kid is yelling at it. And what's he yelling about? So I go in there, and he said, my dad's in Cancun, Mexico, and I need someone to wipe my bottom. I said, you know, nowadays, you're just a little hesitant about stuff, but I say, hey, I can do that for you. So I did it today. He's a teenager now, and I told him, I said, you think I ought to tell that story at your wedding? Or but even the church kids get some fun times. So, anyone else with a question?
You still have romance in your marriage?
Do what?
You still have romance in your marriage?
Wow.
Getting pretty personal, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, how do you describe romance? Boy, you got. You want to answer first?
Well, as you get older, it takes on some deeper meanings, and some of the deeper. Edna is. I really do enjoy her. She is funny. A lot of people see her as this, but she is a prankster. One time when I was out on these meetings somewhere, she went, that's back in the days of fuses, she goes down and takes the fuses out of our fuse box and calls my associate pastor that she don't have lights. And they come over there, and he brings a plumber or something with him, electrician. Anyways. But that's Edna's funny. She's funny to live with. A lot of fun.
You know, I would answer that. I'm a straight shooter. I would answer that. It's difficult. It gets more difficult as you get older to just. And we have fun, but we got to work at doing fun things together. We have to, time-wise, it's like we'd just rather sit at home and do our own thing or go out. You know, laughing together is really important. And I think that's something we need to work. That's something we need to work on.
Yeah.
That's my view.
All right.
Might not be yours.
Anyone else?
Any question?
Technology, phones, how that's changed families, or
what was the question?
How do you navigate changing technology? When you got married, you probably had compulsively, now you've got compulsively. Any words of wisdom for us?
Edna used to have in the kitchen a long cord telephone that she could cradle that between her neck and ear and walk all around the kitchen and do her work, and then would sometimes drag stuff off the counter and it would fall on the floor, break or something with that cord. So when the cordless came out, that was a big step. And then when the cell phones came out, it was big. Yeah, we're doing okay with that, I think. We ask our grandkids.
But it's a challenge. I would say, you know, just looking at our kids with our grandkids, and even for me, when we're babysitting, how easy it is to just put them in front of the TV, or they come with their tablet, and our kids vary in what they allow their kids to do, how much screen time they can have. But man, it's just a real challenge, I think, for the younger generation, to parents, to say no to that.
Just. And we try to honor our children's rules when the kids at the I sometimes will slip them sugar on the side, but other than that, I'm free.
And I would say even for Mel and I mean, Mel got on Facebook like 2 years ago, and it was like, when I got on Facebook, you're going to go and just check things for 10 minutes. Next thing you know, you're on there an hour or more. And sometimes sometimes this is fun when you just sit with both of your phones and read each other off Facebook or something, you know. but yeah.
Okay, I think we'll call it.
I have one more thing.
Okay.
This
All
was
right.
my ending. Is that back in my day, we used to go to workshops, and one of the workshops we went to would be Bill Gothard and Verna Berkey. I don't know if any of you, if that sounds familiar or not, but one of the things that Verna Berkey would say, and I went to a woman's mother's workshop, and she always stayed with me. She said, women, moms, the best gift you can give to your child is to love their dad, and vice versa. The best gift you as a dad can give to your children is to love her mother. And I think that's the challenge of pastoring or wherever, that you make sure that you take care. I would change this and say, how do I take care of myself first instead of my family? How do I take care of myself, my marriage, and my family? Because if we don't do that, we can lose our ministry. So just, it's a challenge, but it can be done with God's help.
And there's when your kids reach a certain age, you know, like if they'd see Edna and I do like kiss or dad, you know, it's like, and especially if they had friends from school there or something. So you go through those stages sometimes where they may throw a fit. But I remember one time one of our kids had a friend there, and Jay was fussing about some affectionate, and I showed, and his friend had the courage to say, I'd give anything to see my mom and dad do that.